right, thanks. So it's very nice to be back here again. Beautiful place. So thanks to Boris and Richard for inviting me. And so, yes, as Richard just told you, they gave me a little bit of a challenge sort of a week before I came here and said, well, why don't you give a tutorial about bacterial genomics? And I don't really consider myself a great expert on bacterial genomics, but you know, I've done some work on it. So it's going to be fairly introductory, mainly targeted at students that don't know much about these things. It's going to be extremely biased towards the viewpoint of a physicist that got into this at some point, and what things I think you might care about, and also what things I feel I know a bit more about. All right, so the first thing to notice is that, so this is a little bit of history. The very first complete bacterial genome was published in 1995, was Haemophilus influenza. This is sort of exactly around the time that I started doing my PhD, even though I was not looking at genomes at all. And since then, every sort of 16 to 18 months, the number of available genomes has been doubling. So this is the total number of complete bacterial genomes as a function of time on a semi-log plot. So you see that by today, we're have sort of 24,000 or something like this in the database. And so I think it's actually good to think a little bit about what this actually gives you, right? So there is about 100 years or more of thinking about evolutionary theory. And I think it's fair to say that all the genetic information is stored in the genome. And so you can now just look at what's in there across many organisms. And you sort of know you have everything there. Right? You have the entire genome there. And so you can just look at what is in these things, sort of independent of any sort of preconceived theoretical ideas you may have about what evolution should do or how it should proceed. And this is sort of how I got into this field. So at some point during my PhD, there was a friend of mine, Martijn Huinen, who was looking at the very few available genomes that there were at this time. And we were looking at a simple question. The simple question was, if you take each gene in the genome compared with all other genes in the genome, how many genes are similar to it, right? So you can compare all the sequences with each other, and you can basically put genes in families that have clear sequence similarity that must at some point in time originate from some common ancestor. And then you can ask, what is the distribution of the size of families? How many groups of 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 genes do you find? And it turns out that to a good approximation, those distributions look like power laws. So the probability to find the family size S goes like S to the to some minus beta. And so this is much more recent data, but here every dot is a genome, and I'm showing you the exponents of this power law for genomes of different total genome size. And so you see there's also a very clear relationship between the slope of this power law and the size of the genome. And this functional form, I don't think anybody understands where that comes from or what explains it.
Do they understand the power law itself?
Right, so, yeah, so there's a lot of talk about this. And I think this was sort of one of the very sort of first ones where we talked about the power law. And since then, there was sort of like a sort of a cottage industry of seeing power laws anywhere. Because, you know, you can count, you know, how many copies certain small words, protein domains, folds, and all these things show power law tails. And some people think that that's maybe very, very meaningful. I don't think it's very, very meaningful. I think it basically sort of reflecting the fact that in evolution, you sort of don't add things, you multiply things. So instead of additive noise, noise is multiplicative, and then under some fairly general conditions, you can get these power law tails. All right. So this is if you look at one genome. If you want to know where do you find all these genomes, so probably this is the place to go to. So NCBI has a database of microbial genomes. If you go there, you get a phylogenetic tree. You can expand this tree and then you can get download any genome and its annotation.
Well, that was the $24,000.
Yes. So just before I came here, I went there. I just downloaded their file with the list of all the genomes and their sizes and their dates.
And if that, you want to make do something useful, you need to know the nomenclature.
Well, I mean, it depends what you want to do, I guess. Right, but so it's basically you can search it in all various kinds of ways, and this is a phylogenetic tree that you can expand, and you can go down and you get all the files. You can just get all the letters or the set of all the genes and the annotations of the genes, all these things. So,
yes. And the comment about the multiplicativity of the noise, so what you mean is that you could fit it with a log normal distribution?
Okay, so. So the central limit theorem says if you add a lot of numbers together, you get a Gaussian. But if you add a lot of numbers together such that, let's say, on average, they are negative, and you introduce a boundary at some lower bound, then you get, instead, an exponential distribution. Right? This is why density of the air drops exponentially, all these things. Right? And so the equivalent of that is a power law in log space. Okay, so if you multiply things together, they tend to shrink, but there is some boundary or there is some influx across this boundary.
It's not very surprising, right?
No, not at all. It isn't surprising at all. And I mean, in the paper, we also said that that's what we think the reason is. But I mean, and some of people that are blamed for that are physicists, right? Because there were some physicists that when they saw power law, they thought, oh, it must be some critical phenomenon. Okay. And then, yeah, okay. But please. All right. So here's another plot I just made. So here, every dot is one of these 24,000 genomes. On the x-axis is how many base pairs are in this genome. On the y-axis is how many genes are in this genome. And so you see the genome sizes, they range from the smallest of sort of like 100,000 base pairs to about 15 million base pairs. But the large majority of the genomes that have been sequenced are somewhere between 1 and 10 million base pairs long. And this in no way gives you a picture of what's the actual distribution of genome sizes in nature, right? These are the genome sizes of the genomes that people have decided to sequence, which have very little to do with the ones that are in the environment, which are probably very much skewed somewhere towards this low end. Right, so especially like in the sea, we know there are these cyanobacteria that dominate bacteria in the oceans, and their genome sizes are around.
Eric, yes. So, I mean, it doesn't make too much sense to look at distribution of genome sizes because you never know what the unit is, right? The unit is species, the unit is how many individuals you find. Right? I mean,
no, cells. It's perfectly fine, right? If I had a way of doing this.
Right, and then a plant has many cells, right?
Yeah, but these are single-celled organisms, right? So I could, you know, I could sort of go somewhere, fish all the bacteria, and if I had a way of doing this, I could look at what were the size, genome sizes of all these bacteria. That's a meaningful question, I think.
Also more, the serious issue is that they're phylogenetically related, right? Or at least they're somewhere. Some of them are similar, some of them are the different parts of the space is very unevenly. Or distribution, so this distribution reflects the sampling bias, as you just said. Right?
So well, this just reflects what people are interested to sequence and what they can sequence, because that's another thing maybe it's worthwhile to say. The vast majority of the bacteria that live in the environment, we can't sequence because in order to sequence them, at least until recently, you have to grow up cells, right? So you can't move from one cell, you have to grow them up, and we cannot find conditions where these want to grow for the vast majority. Can't grow them in class. Yes.
How does it look if you correct for gene density for protein genes?
So okay, that's what this plot is showing, right? So here's the genome size in base pairs. Here's how many protein coding genes there are in the genome, and you see there's a very good linear relationship. So the gene density is basically uniform across all bacteria, and it's about 1,100 base pairs per gene. Okay, that's pretty much this. And some of these fluctuations, I suspect, are more an issue of annotation than actual fluctuations.
Who is the biggest one there?
I don't know. Go here. Look it up. All right. So put it in perspective, so here's the distribution of prokaryotes. I stole this from the internet, this picture. Here are the genome sizes and genomes in viruses. Here are eukaryotes. And I think, you know, one of the things you notice is, apart from the fact that eukaryotes are bigger, this curve starts sort of bending over, right? So the gene count in eukaryotes is going up much slower than their genome size. All right. So now, of course, once you have multiple genomes, you can start comparing genomes. So to give you sort of a flavor, what I did is I randomly went somewhere in this tree on the database, and I ended up with this genome here. This is a Clostridium. And I took a region on the genome. So this is a small region on the genome near the origin of replication. And these little things here are genes. And these are actually genes that are involved in replication itself, most of them. And then I took E. coli, K12, and I asked for each of these genes here, can I find a gene in E. coli that looks like it? Right, so by comparing the sequences, and then you see, actually, you find these matches here. So you see that actually, even the organization of which genes are sitting what, not only can I find sort of similar genes in E. coli for these genes, but even the organization, the way they sit in the genome, is conserved. And these two guys, they are some of the most distantly related bacteria there are, right? So they're more like probably more than a billion years, even more apart. And now this is not typical. I will show you later that things can be extremely plastic. But there are some things that you can even see over these long time scales based on state.
Eric, how fast does this thing grow? And how fast does this grow, and how many copies of ribosome genes are there?
All right, so now, okay, so what does it mean, right, that these genes are similar? Right? What does that mean? Well, what we believe is that if you go back in time, and you go far enough in time, you'll find some ancient ancestor bacterium, and in that ancient ancestor, these genes were already present, and so the RecF gene here in this C. hydrodiginal formans and RecF in E. coli, they basically derive from this common ancestor gene, and this kind of a relationship is called an autology relationship. You would say that these, the RecF in this organism and the RecF in this organism are orthologs, all right? So how do bioinformaticians typically find orthologs? I mean, there are sort of all kinds of complications of this scheme, but in the end, it's actually a very general scheme. So you have two genomes, you want to find orthologs, so you, for each gene in your genome 1, you compare it with all genes in genome 2, and you find, okay, this gene here is the best match to this guy. And now you go from the other end, and you're in genome 2, and you ask for this gene, what's the best match in genome 1? And if that's the same guy, so if it's a reciprocal best match, then you assume it must be an ortholog. Okay, there is some sort of, you know, some extra filters and so on, but this is how you do this. All right, so now once you do this, you can ask how quickly do these orthologs diverge from each other. Right? So here's some data, some picture that Alan Drummond gave to me. So this is in yeast, but it doesn't matter. It works the same in bacteria. So this is Saccharomyces cerevisiae, the one you use for beer and bread and so on, and Saccharomyces bayanus. And they have an estimated 20 million years ago a recent common ancestor. And now for every pair of autologous genes between these guys that are in principle are, you know, separated by the same amount of time, 20 million years, you can line the two genes up and ask how many positions are they different, and then estimate how fast they have diverged. What is the rate of substitutions? And in this picture, two kinds of substitutions are distinguished. So because the mapping from triplets of nucleotides, codons to amino acids is degenerates, sometimes you can do mutations that are called synonymous that don't change the amino acid. So here they look separately at the rate of synonymous and non-synonymous mutations. And so what you see here in the blue line is a histogram of synonymous mutation rates across all autologous genes in these two fungi. And here are the non-synonymous mutation rates, so mutations that change the amino acid. And point of this is to show that there is actually a very large range of evolutionary rates, right? So here, on this end of the distribution, you have a protein where the number of substitutions per site is about 0.4, so every other site has been mutated. Whereas here, on the other end, there's one where it's less than 1 in 1,000. All right, so there's almost 3 orders of magnitude difference in the rate of substitutions. And just for comparison, if you would just assume that they all substitute at the same rate and you just get Poisson fluctuations, then those distributions would look like this. Right? So it's much worthwhile. Yes?
How do you determine most recent common ancestor?
How do you determine the most recent common ancestor?
How do you determine that it's 20 million years?
It's probably 20 million years of some genes and not 20 million years of other genes.
No. I mean, you mean how do you set the time?
Yeah, you're probably basing that on how many mutations there are.
Yeah, so eventually this is all...
It's kind of circular.
How many questionable methods?
Yeah. But so, I mean, the way in which people originally did this, where the first sort of sequences came out, you know, you had the immunoglobulin from a cow and a dog and a human and so on. And then it's actually, you know, you compare it with the fossil record and where these things are. In
this is not much fossil record.
No, but once you have these sort of average rates of substitution in one and the other, you try to generalize from that.
Well, why should the average rate be anything similar at all with bacteria? I mean, generation times, everything else varies by orders of magnitude. Unlike vertebrates, where, you know, you sort of, there's a range of generation times, you sort of expand it and so on, but for bacteria, they're varied by enormous range.
As shown by this graph.
No, yes. This is within one pair of organisms. This is,
yes. All right, so let's say we don't know. All right, so the point that I wanted to make on this, the point that I brought this data up for, is that if you do this between different pairs of species, so you make such a histogram for, you know, human and some other mammal, or 2 flies, or 2 plants, or 2 bacteria, or 2 archaea, and you scale this distribution such that the mode is around 1, right? So you can sort of rescale where the mode is. Then basically you get similarly shaped distributions with similar width. All right? So this distribution of substitution rates is very roughly log normal.
This is for the non-synonymous one?
Yeah, this is for the non-synonymous one. So this is from a paper from Eugene Koonin's group. And so it seems that this wide range of substitution rates and the relative amount of variance in these substitution rates is something fairly universal.
So is it substitution rate per time of year, or is it actually per generation?
You
don't need to know the time of common ancestor for this, right? It's comparing different genes.
Just different genes in the genome. Yeah. You just say, how many times has a certain site, on average, been substituted within this gene? Okay, so one of the questions is, what determines if a gene is on this end or on that end? Okay. What is it that makes a gene slow or fast in its substitution rate? Yes?
So why is this equated with a rate there? Because, I mean, we know there's lateral gene transfer, right? But even the time is going to be vastly different. So how much is this really rate difference and how much is just time difference?
Okay, just hang on, okay? We're gonna get there. I mean, in the end, this curve is this is just made by you take all the pairs and you look at how many positions are different and you have a model that says there's a certain chance per unit time of hitting a position and then you fit a rate and that's all you do.
Okay, right? But what you really see is the divergence, right?
Yes.
Rate times time.
Yes.
And then everything comes later, probably. How to dissect that into rate and into dimension.
The superficial one is that the DS gives you the rate. It gives you the time.
Okay.
But that's, of course, not.
I just told you what you do. Line them up. You look at that. You look at each position, whether it's the same or different. You make a model where you have a certain probability per unit time to hit. And then you assume they're all the same total time apart, and then you get relative rates.
Yeah.
And you only get relative rates.
Yeah, but we know that assumption is not right.
So Sorry?
We know that that's assumption.
No, you don't know this for this yeast, by the way, on this time scale. You don't really know that. But as I said, I'm going to get to that. Okay, so what determines if a gene is diverging fast or slow? It turns out to be actually very hard to find any feature of genes that correlates very well with evolutionary rate. But the best one that has been found so far, so this is a paper by Alan Dromek and Klaus Wilke, is expression level. Right? So this is for yeast and E. coli, and here you see a scatter plot of the mRNA level of a gene, so how high is it expressed in yeast or E. coli, against either its non-synonymous or synonymous substitution rate. And so basically what you find is that the higher expression is a gene, on average, it tends to evolve slower. Yes?
So in average, if you take your average bacterium, of how many of these genes we have a clue about what it's doing?
75%, roughly.
And 25%, mm-hmm. It's like protein, blah, blah, homologue.
No, that's the case when you have a clue of what it might be. The 25% is we have no clue whatsoever.
It's a hypothesized protein.
Sorry?
Hypothesized protein.
Yes.
Of unknown function.
Yes. Okay. All you know is it's such a long string of amino acids that it can't be an accident.
Okay.
But
this is expression level averaged over different environments or one environment? Or?
Yeah, typically they just do this in one environment. All right, and then another one is that another measure is a codon bias. So if you have multiple codons coding for the same amino acid, typically there is one that is favored. And you can also ask for a gene, how strong is the codon bias in this gene? That is, how biased is this gene to use always the favored codon for an amino acid? And that codon bias is positively correlated with mRNA level. So this sort of summarizes the correlations that you see. So the non-synonymous and synonymous substitution rates are positively correlated, the mRNA level and the codon bias are positively correlated, and those two groups of features are negatively correlated with each other. Okay? So the question is, why is this? Why is it that mRNA expression level is the main correlate that you can find of evolutionary rate? And so Drummond and Wilkes proposed explanation for this, called the protein misfolding hypothesis, and it's based on the fact that compared to RNA and DNA polymerases, ribosomes are actually highly error-prone. So ribosomes put the wrong amino acid relatively frequently, and so non-negligible fractions that have been produced of proteins that are being produced by the ribosomes have wrong amino acids in them. And when you have wrong amino acids in your protein, this may cause the protein to misfold. All right, so if you have a misfolded protein, it doesn't work, you have to make it anew, and on top of that, misfolded proteins may also be toxic to the cells.
Eric, is the error rate then?
Sorry?
What is the ribosome error rate?
Yeah, so different people have told me different things. So, but I've heard numbers as high as 10 to the minus 2, and I've heard them as low as 10 to the minus 4. Right, so, but it's sort of...
Amino acid. Yes.
And that sounds high, right, yes.
So amino acid.
Yes, it's probably very dependent on conditions and so on, right? So now, if you're a gene and you want to reduce the fraction of the translations that cause misfolded proteins, there are different things you can do. The first is you can use codons that are less likely to be mistranslated. So if you actually use the codon that is the favorite codon that has the highest concentration of tRNA associated with it, it's less likely that you make an error. And so one thing you can do is, you know, increase your codon bias. And the second thing is, in these proteins, you should imagine that there are many ways that you can change the amino acids in such a way that it still folds in the same way. But different choices of these amino acids may make the fold more or less stable. And so what you can also try to optimize is try to optimize the amino acids you use in such a way that your fold is very stable, so that even if you put one or two wrong amino acids, you will still fold right. All right? So the idea is, of course, that the further you optimize that, the fewer sequences there are that give you that amount of optimization. So mutation would tend to make the proteins less stable and have less coronavirus. And so it's going to be a trade-off between mutation pushing you one way and selection pushing the other way. And there the idea is now that if you're a very high expressed gene, then if you optimize a bit and you lower your fraction of misfolded proteins a bit, that corresponds in absolute terms to a large number of misfolded proteins that you avoid. Whereas if you're a low expressed gene, then of course if you lower it, you only lower the number of misfolded proteins by a much lower amount, and therefore the selection pressure is effectively higher on high expressed proteins. So this would then predict that they have been pushed further into this optimization regime. But further in that regime, you evolve slower because the number of sequences that implement it is slower. Yes?
Excuse me, I don't see how folding is special compared to any other function of the protein in the cell, right? We're just saying if you have to produce lots of protein, if it makes anything wrong, it's going to be a big problem, whereas if it's a protein which is produced at low levels, it can do some strange stuff, and because there's little of it, we don't care. The explanation is the same, but I haven't used any time.
I totally agree with you. But the problem with that is that sort of like the mutational target of let's say, other functional problems,
right,
you would expect to vary a lot from protein to protein. There's no reason to assume that's a uniform number across many different kinds of proteins, right? But it's certainly true that this correlation only explains, I don't know what it is, 20% of the variance or 30% of the variance. So there's a lot of other things there that can give you the additional. Yes?
So following that logic, I feel it's even worse if you make a mistake in the low expressed protein, because the mere fact that the cells are expressing this protein is because they need it. And if you have very few copies of them, and one of them is...
I could turn that argument around and say, well, the fact that they make a lot of them is because they need a lot of them.
The absolute percentage of the errors is much higher in the low expressed ones. Mm-hmm. So how does
that... No, but of course the cell will go to a state where it will make enough, right? So it will adapt its rate of mRNA expression and translation such that you get the right amount of the guys that you need, but you make more than you need because some of them misfold, right? So if 5% of them misfold, you actually, and you need 100, you're making 105 and 5 misfold. That's sort of how it works, right?
Just predict that it should correlate with the length of the gene, because the longer the protein, the more likely you are to have made a mistake.
Yes.
So there should be a correlation with length.
Yeah, I think there is, but I don't have the data with me.
Can I just ask you like a completely, it's a totally different tack question.
Okay.
It's just that many uniquely human neurodegenerative diseases are now thought to be due to misfolded proteins.
Yeah.
So do you think this sort of lower, it's because they're more lately evolved and they have...
Yeah, so Alan is very interested in that, actually. So you should look up his recent work, because he's very interested. So the idea is, right, so if you have cells that no longer divide, then these misfolded proteins that are toxic, they can build up, it could be a big problem, and brain tissue is certainly an area where you might think this
could be. Yeah, right, but I'm more interested in why there might be this preponderance of misfolded proteins, particularly in humans. Like, do you think it has something to do with
the fact that
they're later evolved and they haven't developed some of these adaptations?
No, I think all organisms have misfolded proteins. All right, so now I want to switch gears, and I was looking now at some patterns across large evolutionary timescales. And now I want to look at very short evolutionary timescales and say, if you take a set of genomes that are closely related, what's the way in which their genomes are evolving? And although what I'm going to show you is in no way due to work from my group, When I was Googling around for good illustrations, I actually found it hard to find nice illustrations, so I made some illustration from my own data. So we are, for various reasons, working with a set of E. coli, the wild strains of E. coli that all came from one place. So this is the border of Lake Superior in Minnesota, and this is where all these E. coli were coming from. These were taken by the group of Mike Sadowski, and he shared them with us. So we have sort of 500 different strains of E. coli, and about 100 of them we have sequenced. And here is a phylogenetic tree that you can reconstruct of these sequence genomes. So all the little colored dots that you can't see, by the way. This is the lab strain K12MG6055. So all the colored dots are our strains, and all the non-colored dots are other strains from the database.
There's a certain arbitrariness about what we're defining as E. coli, which is based on metabolic criteria.
Yes.
So I mean, there's tremendous, you know, you sort of say, well, it's gram negative, it does this, that, and the other thing, it's E. coli.
Yes, but there is some mafia somewhere that has some test.
Yes.
And it says, you know, if you grow here and here and here and not on that, then you're an E. coli.
Right.
Okay? And these guys are E. coli by that test.
Okay.
So
this phylogeny is from using many different proteins?
All the genes that they share.
But using all of them together? Or using
all of them together. I don't want to talk about that. All of them together. Just to give you a sense of the scale, right, so this length is 3% divergence. So all these guys, even the first apart, are more than 90% identical. All right? It's quite interesting, by the way, these are all the different kind of, you know, types of E. coli that are recognized. All of these guys from all across the tree are found there at the edge of Lake Superior living together. But what I want to do right now is I want to focus here on this little group here of very, very closely related guys. And I'm just going to show you some results of if you take a pair of these guys and compare them with each other, right? So this genome here, which is called E4 because it was in that well of the 96-year-old plate, and this genome called F3. And so we took this genome here that was assembled, and then we took the reads from the sequencing of this genome and mapped them to genome E4. And what I'm showing you here is along the x-axis is the genome. This curve here shows you in a sliding window what is the coverage of reads from this genome to genome E4 locally. And here in this curve in the blue, you see what's the rate of SNPs. Okay, so per 500 base pairs, how many nucleotides have been substituted between the two. And so what you see is that over large stretches, this SNP rate is very, very low. So the average SNP rate in these areas here is about 8 SNPs per 100,000 base pairs. Okay, this is sort of closer than two humans are, typically. But you do find, if you look at coverage, that there are like these holes, right? So the coverage hits zero in a whole bunch of places. That means these are pieces in genome E4 that don't exist in F3. And some of these are actually, you know, considerable holes. So there are genes that E4 has that F3 doesn't have. Okay, and there's a whole bunch of them. And if you were to do it the other way around, you would also find holes. Okay, so there's both ways. And then what is also interesting, there are these blocks here where the rate of substitutions is also much higher. Okay, so there are these well-defined blocks. They're sort of, you know, kilobases, 10 kilobases, 50 kilobases, something long. And there the SNP rate is sort of 1 to 3%. Okay? Much, much, much higher. So where is this coming from? Well, everybody in the community agrees that what is most likely happening is that these E. coli are living together, and chunks of DNA from one E. coli that is more distal related make it into the other E. coli, and through homologous recombination, a chunk of one E. coli genome replaces the homologous chunk of the other genome. All right? So there is a whole zoo of mechanisms for this. Yes?
The mafia says E. coli has no natural transformation.
Yes. No, that's true. Okay, so I'm just now showing you several mechanisms. Whether E. coli has this particular one, E. coli, that's another question, right? So there's a whole zoo of mechanisms for exchange of genetic material across bacteria. So just for educational purposes, right? So if this is the genome and there are genes on this genome, H, A, B, C, and so on, then in the environment, there may be pieces of DNA floating around that are homologous. Some cells can take up these fragments. And then basically when the DNA is replicating, what can happen is basically the DNA polymerase falls off, makes a mistake, and reattaches to this other piece of DNA, with the net effect that a stretch of genes in this genome is replaced by a homologous stretch from another organism. Okay? And importantly, this only requires the edges of the fragments to be homologous. So it could be that, for instance, in this chunk here, there were three more genes between A and B, and you could get such a recombination, therefore get extra genes come in or out of the genome. And as I said, there's a whole zoo of these mechanisms available. So here's a review, for example, where they go through a whole bunch of these mechanisms that are now known. So one that is thought to be quite important is, as Dan was saying, phages are extremely common in the environment, probably tenfold as common as cells. And so, you know, a phage may infect one cell. This is the blue DNA. It starts replicating itself. At some point, it starts packaging this back into phages, but when it packages it, it will also package some DNA from the host cell. So that's the red stuff. Okay, now the phage gets out, infects another cell, and now in this other cell, some DNA that came from this other bacterium is being inserted, and again, through homologous recombination. Or other mechanisms, also other insertion mechanisms, we can insert it to the genome. Yes.
No, I agree. It could be transduction or it could be conjugation. But what is interesting is that these events are occurring. What you're doing is saying how we could get this variation. But why would you have a substitution in the population of this new variant? I mean, one cell lost the gene, one cell acquired the gene, but then the clone became established. So there's a whole bunch of population genetics that we have to deal with. This is just talking about how you're generating the variation.
Yes.
And the thing that's really fascinating, you know, like if we take 0157, E. coli 0157, only and E. coli K12, this 20% of the genome is not homologous at all. And they're all officially E. coli. So there's all of this horizontal transfer that you're pointing out. But what's really interesting is that it does become established. And I'm sure Don will tell you why, but it's truly
a very interesting
subject.
To hear from Don.
I don't know the answer. I'm just saying that there's some really intriguing population genetics there.
I agree. So, all right, so the point is there are many of these mechanisms that can allow DNA from one bacterial cell to get incorporated to another one. And when people have tried to look at sort of what determines if between two types of cells the rate of transfer is high or low, there are a couple of obvious things that have been noticed. So one important thing is homology. So for this homologous recombination to work, you need stretches of homology, and so if you're more than 90% identical, this is very likely to work. Once you become less than 90% identical, become less and less likely that this will work, and so this really seems to be a barrier that is much more likely that you get homologous recombination between close guys than between genomes that are further apart, which is actually the reason why, to answer your question, that on longer time scales, once guys move sort of outside of that horizon, they may their rate at which they switch genes may now become so much lower that they're effectively now separated species, right?
Do they continue to swap stuff that is very conserved?
Yeah, so that's very interesting, right? So there are some papers from the ALM group, for example. It's very interesting where you have related species that are sort of different ecotypes. And so there are some genes that are important for the ecotype, and they can't switch because that gene will functionally not work in the other guy and the other way around. But then there are other genes that are much more conserved that they do keep on switching, right? So you see that they separate into two clades according to some genes, but not to other genes, right? So this stuff can be really complex, right?
But we would see this somehow, right? If you had like now this, not just two species, but three species.
Yes. Well, I mean, these are some of the things we're actually struggling with our strains, right? I mean, what? I mean, you can build trees of genes and stuff. Okay, let me just move on a little bit. All right, so now to show a couple of results that have to do with what, if you compare genomes of closely related species, I'm going to use some data from some results from this paper here. So this is Touchon et al. From 2009, PLOS Genetics. They compared 20 E. coli genomes, and they first build a phylogeny on all genes that occur in all genomes. Right? So you can give this to your phylogeny builder. You can give it an alignment of all genes that occur in all genomes and say, build me the best phylogenetic tree that is consistent with the, has most consistency with the distances between all those genes. But what you will see is that if you now look at any one gene in the genome, all of these genes will not support that phylogeny of the whole thing. Okay? So the numbers that you see here in gray, for example, so here's a number, it says 61%. So 61%, so the fact that these three genomes form a clade, that's another way of saying that these three genomes are closer to each other than they are to any of the other genomes in the set. It's called a bipartition. And now you can ask, if I look gene per gene, what fraction of genes actually supports this bipartition, supports that these three guys are closer to each other than anyone else? It's 60%. And in fact, there's nothing here that's supported 100%. Right? So every gene has its own phylogeny and clearly rejects the phylogenies of the other genes. And that's just reflective of the fact that this stuff is happening all the time between closely related species. And so between closely related strains, they're not really reproducing asexually at all. Okay. It's much more like, you can't build a phylogeny of us here either, because different genes in our genomes have different relationships. And it's the same if you take a set of E. coli.
Is there evidence that they swap complete genes, or they swap like one gene at a time, or 10 genes, or
It depends on who you ask, but my impression is that the chunks that are swapped are 4, 10, or even 100 kb long. So typically they're, 1, 2, 10 genes sort of long.
Huh? Yeah, people will certainly claim small numbers in other contexts. KB scale.
Yes.
How much fits into a phage? I mean, how much can you swap?
Depends on the phage.
or how large are the linkage blocks, the blocks that you see in your sequencing? The blocks that you showed us, high divergence locally between closely related strains, how long are they?
These blocks.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Right, so this is 1 million. So what? So 110, this is 100 kb. So this would be 80 kb, this would maybe be 30 kb, something like this.
But wouldn't the size, average size, depend on what method is being used to swap genes as well?
Presumably, yes. All right, so now this tree was built from all the genes that all these genomes should have. Yes.
Sorry, one second, just about the same graph. So these guys are synthetic, so the genes are in the same position in the genome, or do they swap around?
Because they swap around also.
Yeah, but
that's hidden. So we did that on purpose because it makes things much more complicated. So we take one genome that's assembled, and we just take the reads that are 150 base pairs long from the sequencing of the other genome and just align them to the other genome. And so if things have swapped around and so on, which also happens all the time, or flip, that's sort of disappearing because the length scale here where we see something is like 150 base pairs.
Right, so because you don't have causal evidence that these two strains actually swapped anything, this could be a single event in which a whole chunk got swapped and then got re-swapped.
Possible. I don't believe that, but...
No, you only convex from the sampling that makes the convex
Yeah.
What was actually the percentage that you've been able to cover? How many from?
I'll show this. This sort of gives you an answer to this question. So, okay. So this was based on genes that occurred in all genomes, but actually the number of genes that all these 20 E. coli share is much smaller than the number of typical genes within one E. coli. So a typical E. coli has between 4,000 and 5,000 genes. But if you ask how many genes are there that occur in all 20, that's about 2,000. All right, so this shows you, this is called the core genome. It says if you take a set of N related genomes, how many genes do they share? That's sort of the intersection. And so here you have between 4,000 and 5,000, then it quickly drops as you go to larger genome sizes. And vice versa, the pangenome is the union of all genes from all organisms. And you see that basically if you take these 20 E. coli, the pangenome is up to 18,000 genes. Okay? So there are very large differences in gene content. If you go to these two E. coli on opposite sides of the phylogeny, even though among the chunks that they share, they might be 95% identical, more than half of their genes are not the same.
This 18,000 is just within the second genome.
Just within the 20. Just within the 20 genomes from Touchon.
That's from the Touchon.
We probably have a lot more, but we're. I mean, there's. Okay, I don't want to get into it. All right, so how do you gain genes and losses? So there are simple mechanisms like tandem duplications. So one copy may go to two copies. Of course, they can be deleted again. As a general rule, people have found that deletions are more common than duplications. So unless you select for keeping a gene, it will wither away over time. And but if you look in the literature, there are lots of people that actually claim that if you now compare a set of genomes and ask the genes that were gained and lost and that are different between these genomes, where they come from, they claim there's actually more of them came from horizontal transfer events than came from such gene duplication and divergent events. And so the sort of qualitative mental picture that I have of what's going on is that in any environment, there's basically a huge pool of all genes from all genomes that are living in an environment that is constantly being shuttled around by phages and plasmids and other things, and all these cells can take them up. And then depending on whether you have enough homology to do homologous recombination, you can incorporate them at a high rate. And so gene content can rapidly diverge even between very close species. And so here's a final picture from the paper, on a penultimate picture from that paper by Touchon et al. That shows you the estimated number of gene gains and losses along each branch of this tree. And so this is a complicated picture, so you should ignore most of it. But basically along each branch, at the top of a branch is a red number and a black number. And those are the number of genes that they estimate were gained and lost along that branch. And so even if you go among, you know, the sort of the closest related species, you may get 1,000 genes coming and going between them. Okay. All right.
There was no obvious correlation between branch length and the number, right?
I haven't looked, but there is some. I know from our data that as you go further away, then the content goes down. So there's some pattern, but it's not, you know, but you lose it fairly fast, right? So there's for some period of time you can see the similarity, and then at some point, just. So now, this coming and going of genes, is it completely random or are certain patterns in it? So one of the patterns that people have noticed is that if you make a histogram of all these genes from the PAM genome and say how many of them occur only in one genome, how many occur in 2, 3, 4, up to 20, you see that by far most genes occur in only one or two genomes. And there is another set of genes that essentially occur in all genomes. And it's actually quite unlikely that you have a gene that occurs in half of the genome. Okay? And so there's been recently some speculation of where this kind of a pattern comes from. Can you come up with a theoretical explanation? And so I want to make a plug for this by a paper from Sergei Maslov, which I think is very amusing. I don't know if it's true, but I like the idea very much, which basically he observes essentially the same distribution if you take Ubuntu installation. So you can go to Ubuntu and you can get information, statistics of what packages different people have installed, right? And so you can then also make a histogram like this and say, okay, how many packages occur only, on one computer, and how many, everybody has. And you get and you get essentially the same distribution. And so his idea is that basically, well, with Ubuntu packages, when you install one package, it may depend on having other things installed. And so it will go down this dependency tree and install for you all the other packages that it's dependent on. And so the idea that this sort of this core genome are sort of the packages you always end up having, because no matter what kind of things you hit at random, the things you want, you're going to go through these guys here. You're going to need them.
So, Eric, an yes. alternative way of looking at Ubuntu is looking what these genes actually are, right? So they're going to be like ribosome and stuff like
yes,
that.
Yes, but it's true, right? Just like in Ubuntu, there's, X library or something like this, right? These things are the ribosome and stuff like this, right? But the idea is that the statistics of this distribution reflect the statistics of dependencies of genes on each other. It only makes sense to add this gene to your genome if you have these other things already installed. All right.
Particularly when you're talking about deletions, because you will delete the ones that you have, that you've got, that you don't need.
Right.
So presumably in practice, you get some random mixture and you dilute the ones you don't
yes.
need, the bacteria. It's something
yes.
different than how one, well, I don't know, I try to run my computer.
Ah, yes, that's true.
Right.
All right. So I wanted to make take 1 minute to make a plug for bioinformatics. So bioinformatics is not a very sexy topic, many people think of this as not really, science is more like a technology that you just happen to need, so you need a guy to just churn the things and align and so on. I just want to remind you, right, that all we ever got, sort of, was this. Okay? We got very, very long strings of A, C's, G's, and T's. If you sequence these genomes, that's what you got. Okay? And so somehow you have to go from there. And
it's worth that, right? You get it chopped up.
Yeah.
You got long
strings.
Yeah,
error.
Get it chopped up. Get it in a billion pieces. Yeah. So, I think it's actually quite remarkable that over these few decades that bioinformatics developed, that there are now tools that are actually fairly high quality, where you can give a sequence like that, and it will find all the genes in your genome. You know what the amino acid sequences of your genes are. You can find out what other genes in other organisms your genes are related to. For about 75% or so of your genes, you can get at least a rough idea of what the function is. You often can even find out what parts within your gene are responsible for different aspects of this function. And
the function is saying it's some member of some operative
yes,
of the function.
Yes. Right. It says it's a transporter of some molecule of this rough type, right? That's sort of the kind of things you get. And all of this is in the end based on alignment of sequences. So I want to now say something about function. So how do you assign functions to genes? So to a very, very rough approximation, you can think of proteins as stringing together one, two, three, or a few protein domains. And what are protein domains? Protein domains are, to a reasonable approximation, functional units, so that a domain will, for example, bind DNA, or it will bind to another protein and cause us to make a dimer, or it will be some catalytic domain of an enzyme. And they are structural units, so you can cut them out of a longer protein. You can just take the domain, and it will fall by itself, and it will still have this function, right? And lots of people in molecular biology use this, right? So you can take the DNA binding domain from one gene and combine it with the activation domain of another gene and put them together in a protein, it will work, okay? And these protein domains are sort of atomic in the sense that you cannot split them into smaller functional units. You cannot have half a domain, it won't work, won't fall, won't do anything. And so what bioinformaticians have been doing is been basically collecting example sequences that that belong to the same protein domain and making big multiple alignments of these examples of different sequences that correspond to the same protein domain, and then make mathematical models that basically represent the sequence preferences of what amino acids occur at what positions in such a protein domain. So they do this with hidden Markov models, and so now you have these databases, for example, like PFAM, where you have over 10,000 of these families that correspond to protein domains. You have multiple alignments. You have mathematical models that represent the sequence biases within these alignments, and you can use them now and run them over your new genome and find hits to all these protein domains, and in this way can get an annotation of what kind of protein you have, right? So there might be one of these 10,000 families is a known DNA binding domain, and if you now run with this hidden Markov model over your sequences, you get a hit, you know, that protein in my organism has such a DNA binding, all right? And this is the way people make annotation. So the nice thing of having such things is that you can now, in an unbiased way, go through genomes and start counting how many genes are there that have different kinds of function. Okay? Get some rough ideas. So this is something that I did at some point. And what you find, I thought, was quite surprising. So in this plot, every dot is, again, a genome. On the x-axis is the total number of domains that have a known functional annotation that you find in the genome. And on the y-axis is how many domains you see in this genome with a particular function. So in blue, for example, shows you how is the number of domains that play a role in a metabolic process varying across these genomes. In green is how many domains involved in translation, and in red, how many domains involved in transcription regulation. This is a log-log plot, so the fact that you see straight lines mean that the numbers of genes in these different functional categories grow as power laws in the total genome size. Right? So for example, for the metabolic process, the slope is actually quite close to 1. It means the number of metabolic genes is scaling linearly with genome size. Every time you go to a genome that's twice as big, you get 2 times as many metabolic genes. But for transcription regulation, the slope is almost 2. Okay, so that means a quadratic relationship. Every time you double your size of your genome, you get about 4 times as many transcription factors. And I didn't just pick these three categories because they make nice straight lines. You find these kind of straight lines and log-log plots for almost any high-level functional category you pick. So basically, you see that for 90% of the domains, more than 85% of the variance in the scatter is explained by a straight line fit. So this is actually 4 functional categories that occur in most genomes, you find such scaling laws. And if you look at the slopes that you get, the exponents, you will notice that those categories that have the lowest slopes are involved in very basic processes, translation, DNA replication, DNA repair. On the other side of the scale, those categories with the steepest slopes, whose numbers go up fastest with genome size, are regulatory. So signal transducers, transcription factors, those are the categories with the biggest slopes.
So how do your different categories map on this Euclidean package distribution?
I wish I could do that. How do I do that?
So for example, there were your DNA replication category or whatever. So you would expect that they would show up in, everybody has that, right? So they would just show up.
You want to do it like that. Okay. Now I understand. Yes. I have not done that. Good idea. So, all right. So now, I want to take these scanning laws and say, what does that mean for the evolution of gene content? Right? Somehow, the fact that all genomes that we have fall on these straight lines means there is some constraint in the way gene gains and losses are evolving. And I just want to work out what are these constraints.
Can I add a question number of this? The maximum number you had on there was about 5,000 domains.
Yeah, annotated.
The big ones have 10,000 proteins. So this is a lot of, to some substantial fraction of all the proteins, there are no domains you can do this with.
Well, first of all, in this data, these are pictures all from different studies, right?
Yeah.
And different sets of genomes.
Yeah.
So this is now 6 years ago. And so the biggest one here, I think its genome size was something like 8,000 genes or something like this. And so it had, close to 5,000 domains with a known function.
Yeah. Which is, so that's correlated with this unknown function of large number of genes.
Yes, some reasonable fraction.
We have several domains of known function. And
yes. Yeah, that's transposons that move around. And it's the fastest, yes. All right, so if we want to work out what are the implied constraints on the evolution of gene content, we need a simple model. So the simple model we're going to have is that I'm going to look at the evolutionary history of one particular genome, and I trace it back in time. And so NGT is the total number of domains that existed in the ancestor of genome T, G, that was living at time T. Okay? And NC of GNT is the number of domains in category C that was living in the ancestor of genome G at time C. So we think of an organism as a bag of domains, and we sort of at least mentally can imagine that we go backward in time and see how these are the numbers have changed through time. All right, so now the question is, if I want all my genomes that live today to observe these scaling laws, what do I have to assume? Okay, so I'll make a simple assumption that there is some phylogenetic tree that underlies the relationship between all the genomes that are living today, that there was some common ancestor here, and so these different colored lines represent the different histories of the different genomes. And so first of all, they all started from this common ancestor. And instead of looking at the numbers of total number of domains and the number of domains in category C, I look at the logs of these numbers. So I call that X and XC. All right? And so very simply, the XC for genome 8 today is equal to XC here at the common ancestor plus an integral over time of simply, dxc, which is dn over nc. Right? So this is just math. I'm just doing math. And the same for the total number of genes, total number of domains. So this is category C. This total, you have a similar integral. But our scaling law says that xc must be a linear function of x and the same linear function for all genomes. Right? So that's the important thing, is that it is the same function for all genomes that you pick. And that basically says that these two integrals must be equal to each other. So the integral of change in total number of genes over how many genes there are at that point in time over the evolutionary history is equal to this integral of the change of the number of genes in category C over the total number of genes in category C times this exponent alpha C, and this must hold for all genomes, right? So basically what it says is that the relative rate of adding genes in category C relative to the average rate of adding any gene has to be equal. The ratio of these two must be alpha C, and that's true for each genome. It's saying if you average over enough evolutionary time, the rate of adding genes in a certain domain versus any kind of in a certain category for all categories is a constant ratio. Okay. That's what it says. Now, if you make one more assumption, if you say, I'm going to assume that these scaling laws are time invariant. So if I had gone back 100 million years and I would have gathered genomes then, I would have found the same scaling laws. Okay? Then basically the constraint goes from a constraint on the entire integral two constraints that must work over each sort of small unit of time. So basically, the constraint says change in the number of domains in category C over the total number in category C is equal to change in the total number of domains over total number of domains times this exponent alpha C. Right? You can rewrite this and say, if I actually look at what is the fraction of all changes, gains or losses that happened, that were in category C, relative to what fraction is all, what is the fraction of all domains in the genome that is category C, then this fraction is bigger or smaller by a multiplicative factor alpha C. Right? So that is to say, if I were to randomly add and remove genes, then the fraction of all events that would fall in category C would just be equal to what fraction of all genes is in category C. But this says basically that certain categories like transcription factors are hit twice as often as the average ones. Mm-hmm. So that's basically what you need to have to get these game laws. Okay? Now you can check if that's actually true. So what you can do is you can take pairs of genomes that are relatively closely related. And what you do is by comparing these two genomes, you estimate what is the total number of gains and losses that happen between these two genomes, and what is the total number of gains and losses that involve genes in category C. And then the prediction would be that if you take the ratio of these two numbers and divide it by what's the fraction in these two genomes of all domains that belong to category C, then that ratio, which we call the evolutionary potential rho C, should be equal to the scaling exponent alpha C.
But since these are variable, is it clear that the sort of first moment is the one you want, or is it not clear which? It's some property of distribution, which is what the delta NCs and delta Ns that the model needs to predict. And it's not obvious this is the right number.
Okay, so I think that's more an issue of that it's hard to estimate how many events have taken place, given that you just know the difference.
No, it's the fact that it's stochastic, not just the stochastic be adding some one another, and on average it's alpha. But alpha is some average.
Yes.
And but when you're taking samples and you're trying to...
Yeah, but I've now gone to... By claiming time invariance, I'm saying it's essentially constant. Right, so the rate is constant in time.
The average rate is constant time, but it's fluctuations as well, just stochastic fluctuations.
Okay. All right, so this is showing you that to a reasonable approximation, this is true. So here for 156 categories that are ubiquitous in the sense that 95% of all genomes have at least one genome category, this is the scaling exponent of the scaling law, and this is this rho C. And I think this is actually quite interesting or meaningful because this quantity here is a structural quantity. Right? So what you do is you take all genomes and you plot genome size against the number of genes in this category and you fit the slope. Right? So this is from genomes from all over the tree of life. And here I'm looking pairs of genomes that are closely related and I'm estimating what fraction of all events, the gene gains and losses that have taken place over the short period of time that these two guys diverge from each other belong to category C. And these two quantities indeed correlate well with each other. All right. So these parameters are in a sense sort of constants of the evolutionary process, and it says the relative rates of adding and removing genes in different categories are fixed in all evolutionary
relationships. So does the slope depend on the time horizon in your system?
Not that we can tell. So you're wondering why is it not one and why is there not?
Because you're the moment where it's stochastic, and so you wouldn't expect it to be one.
Let's talk about it. Because I don't. Maybe you're right, but I don't understand here. All right. So I want to just go back to this. Right. Remember that I said that the size of gene families, how many genes you get that are similar to each other, are parallel and distributed. I think so. The fairly recent paper from Marco Cosentino Lago Morsina's lab. Very nicely shows that there's actually a close relationship between these two laws. So what they've shown here is the gene family size distribution for different genomes. So every genome here, every line here is a different genome, and it shows the gene family size distribution. And these black ones are genomes that are large, and the red ones here are genomes that are small. So it's color-coded from small genomes to large genomes. And you see, as we said before, that the slope is steeper for small genomes than for larger genomes. Now what they did is they said, instead of taking all genes and build this gene family size distribution, let's build a gene family size distribution only for those genes that belong to a particular functional category. Okay, let's say only transcription factors. And then again, you get, you know, it's more noisy now, but you roughly get scaling loss. And you can determine the slopes of these scaling loss as well. And basically what you find is that the ratio of the slope for the whole genome versus the slope of one functional category is actually equal to this scaling loss exponent alpha c. Right? And it fits with this idea that basically this alpha c says how sort of active evolutionary this functional category is. The rate of gains and losses are proportional to this alpha c, and a model like that will indeed explain why this ratio of exponents has to be equal to this alpha c. All right, so the last thing, few minutes, I want to tell you a little bit about the consequences for the topology of the transcription regulatory network of the fact that the number of transcription factors scales quadratically with the number of genes in the genome. This is in fact how I discovered this thing, because I was working on trying to reconstruct transcription regulatory networks and what is their topology, and I got very frustrated because I couldn't really find any reproducible things, and I thought, okay, maybe I should just start looking by how does it rescale if you rescale the size of the genome, so let's first ask how does the total number of transcription factors rescale if you go to genomes of different sizes, and then so I found the quadratic. Now just 1 minute to say what is a transcription regulatory network. It's a very simplified version. Each genome has a set of transcription regulators. Each of these transcription regulators have a certain sequence specificity, so they bind to sequences, particular kinds of sequences. Now if you go across all genes in the genome, then in the promoter upstream of these genes, there can be binding site for these transcription factor. And to the first approximation, the transcription regulatory network consists of saying what are all the transcription factors, what are their binding specificities, and map all the binding sites of all these transcription factors upstream of all the genes.
How far do you consider upstream on the promoter?
I'll talk to that afterwards. Not relevant right now. This is all bacteria, so these are 300 base pairs long. So you look at the entire intergenic region. So you can now make a cartoon picture of the transcription regulatory network. So here are all the regulators, these colored balls. These are non-regulatory genes. And I've drawn an arrow every time a regulator regulates a particular gene. Now the point I want to draw your attention to is that I can now count the total number of edges in this graph in two ways. Either I can go over all genes, and calculate what is the average number of incoming edges per gene. So if I take the average number of incoming edges per gene multiplied by the total number of genes, I get the total number of edges. But I can also go over all regulators, calculate the average out degree, how many genes is each regulator regulating, and then if I multiply the average out degree times the number of regulators, I also get the total number of edges in this graph. But as I just showed you, the number of regulator scales is the square of the number of genes in the genome. And it follows from that that the ratio between the average in degree and the average out degree must be proportional to genome size. Okay, so as you go from small to larger genomes, the topology of the gene regulatory network must change. And in particular, the ratio between the average in degree and the average out degree must grow linearly. And so we were interested, which of the two is it? Is this one going up? Is that one going down? Or is it some combination of the two? So we spent some time looking at that. And the way we did it, I'm not explaining this, but you collect from all across the bacterial phylogeny, you collect clades of four or five species at a time that are close enough that you can align them, but far enough that they had time to mutate in their intergenic regions. And these different clades correspond to genomes of different sizes. And then basically what we looked at is we studied the conservation patterns in the intergenic region to estimate what is the number of binding sites per intergenic region across these different clades of organisms. And the idea was, because I originally was very convinced that this is the number that's going to go up. As you go to more complex genomes, you have more complex regulation, you have more regulatory inputs. So I should see that reflected, that I can detect more conserved binding sites in epigenetic regions. To make a long story short, that's not what we find. So if you actually look at the evidence of selection conserving positions across genes and in intergenic regions, you see all kinds of patterns that make sense. So within coding regions, second positions are the most conserved, then first positions, then third positions, and silent sites show no evidence. That's basically because we sort of took this as the baseline. In intergenic regions, you see elevated evidence of conservation. You can see here this peak that occurs in almost every clade of bacteria. That's the Shine-Dalgarno binding site for ribosomes. You see that there is selection on synonymous sites at the start of the gene. This has to do with making sure translation initiation works well. But if you look at the amount of conservation that you see in intergenic regions as a function of the size of the genome, you see no correlation whatsoever, zero. Okay? And the poor student had to do controls for 2 years before he convinced me that there is none. And so one simple thing that you can look at is just look at the size of intergenic regions, right? So if this in degree is really proportional to genome size, then if you go from one genome to a genome that's 10 times as big, then you would need 10 times as many binding sites per intergenic region, and you would maybe think that these regions grow. But they don't grow at all, right? So here we have three kinds of intergenic regions. This one is upstream of two genes that are divergently transcribed. These green ones are upstream of one and downstream of another, and the blue ones are downstream of two genes. And you see that indeed the red regions are bigger than the green, that are bigger than the blue, right? Because they may need space for binding sites, but there is no correlation with genome size whatsoever. Okay, so what we concluded is, and we have more evidence, but I don't have time to show it, is that the number of inputs per gene is constant, and the consequence is that the out degree must be going down, like one over genome size. So the picture of sort of how the regulatory network rescales in prokaryotes is that, you know, when you go from one regulatory network of one genome to one that's twice as big, right, so here the colored balls are regulators, and these are, again, non-regulatory genes. So here every gene has one input. There are two regulators. Now I double the genome size. I now have 8 regulators, right, goes times 4. Still, every gene has one input that hasn't changed. But now the average out degree of these regulators has gone from 5 to 2.5, right? So as you go from smaller to bigger genomes, the number of regulatory inputs per gene stays the same. But the regulators get more and more specialized, right? And you get many, many more of them.
So that means more binding sites, the larger vocabulary of binding sites?
Yes, so that's another piece of evidence that we have. So if you look at the vocabulary of conserved stuff, that is going up very fast with genome size. Mm-hmm. Yes?
In the out degree, you count arrows also that go from regulator to regulator.
Yes. Or to themselves.
Or to themselves.
All right, so this, I'll close with this. So this, I think, uncovers a fundamental difference in regulation between prokaryotes and eukaryotes. So in bacteria, we found that the average in degree of the number of regulatory inputs per gene is constant. And my interpretation of that is bacteria have not evolved mechanisms to put the gene under the control of many regulators. All right, so you can, in a bacterium, you can put 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 binding sites near the transcriptor start site, and then it's just game over. Can't do anymore, and that's why this number is not going up. But in multicellular eukaryotes, it's very different. The number of regulatory, there's lots of evidence to indicate that the number of regulatory inputs per gene is going up dramatically as you go to bigger genomes. I'm here showing, for example, how much real estate, genomic real estate, are you using per gene in bacteria in blue and in eukaryotes in red. And you see, as probably most of you know, that as you go to larger eukaryotes, all of a sudden intergenic regions explode. Okay? And we also know that in eukaryotes, a gene can be regulated by many cis-regulatory elements that are very far away from the start of the gene, which does not occur in prokaryotes. And so I think there's a fundamental difference between eukaryotes and prokaryotes. And if you ask me, what is it that eukaryotes have that bacteria do not? My guess is that it's chromatin structure. So in contrast to prokaryotes and eukaryotes, the DNA is covered in nucleosomes, right? It's closed up. And basically, the cells themselves dynamically regulate which parts of the chromatin is opened up and accessible to transcription factors. And this gives sort of an extra joint to this regulatory process that allows you to have these more regulatory inputs. That's it. Thanks for staying.
Well, thanks a lot, Eric. So a few questions. Just a few logistical remarks. It's 10 to 1 now. Who meets when where?
Yeah. So, Paul, the students...
We should meet at 2 o'clock. Okay? Mm-hmm. You're happy with that? Over in the lab. And if you have time to go to the lab before 2 o'clock, then please do so. And certainly those that plated the fluctuation test on Wednesday, collect your data. And we'll arrange for that to be uploaded onto a class website for the analysis.
So everyone goes to the lab? Or?
Yes, everyone to the lab too, and we'll take stock of various things and plan accordingly.
There's a pressing question?
Just about, it seems to be bacteria have like a maximum genome size.
Yeah.
Your arguments say anything about
I took that slide out.
Degree going to
So obviously, if the number of regulators grows quadratically, at some point you would have more regulators than you have genes, which is not possible. So you could try to use this as an argument for why there's an upper bound on prokaryotic genome size. And if you, okay, so basically you get a number that is too big by 2 or 3-fold if you do a naive calculation. Now there are several people that then sort of start saying, well, maybe this, maybe that, and talk the number down. But you know, if you're fitting one number, then you can fit anything you want.
Yeah, sure.
So, but I don't think it's unreasonable to assume that regulatory overhead may be one of the things that limits genome growth in bacteria. That qualitatively seems reasonable to me.
Okay, student question? Why are you hungry?
Yeah, it's late.
Well, thanks again, Eric.